Welcome, aviators, to another episode of Ask the CFI. My name is Chris Palmer. I'm founder of Angle of Attack, where I do a lot of different flight training type of things. Of course, there's a lot available on YouTube where you may be seeing this video now, but you may be listening to the audio on our podcast. We have a podcast as well called Aviator Cast. Lots of content for you guys all the time. This Ask the CFI is an opportunity for me to take community questions and answer them. I actually do this live on Instagram. And so if you do want to participate live, enter your question in like Sunday night, Monday morning. I do this sometime during the day Monday, and it works out pretty well that way. I do it live, and then I have this put up on YouTube. So all of these questions that are to come are in the description on YouTube, and you can click the time code, which brings you to that question that I answer. And that works out pretty well. All right. So appreciate you guys being here. Go to angleofattack.com. And we have plenty of videos there as well. In addition to online ground school that you can participate in an official capacity that will get you moving toward a license. And also Checkride ACE, which is a checkride preparation program. If you guys are in that final stretch toward a checkride and you want to ace that checkride, it's a program I put together to make sure all the nuts and bolts are in pieces and you're well studied for that moment when you take that test. So here we go. Let's dive into Ask the CFI. Hope you guys enjoy. This was an interesting one that came across, and I like it because it's a bit different from a lot of the questions we get. We get a lot of aviation career questions here on Ask the CFI, but I like this one because it was a little bit out in left field. So Class Golf Airspace. Class Golf Airspace is the only uncontrolled airspace we have. It's not charted unless it's like at a different altitude. And so you'll actually see some of this in Eastern Alaska. There's kind of the, what I call like the castle wall around a big area, Eastern Alaska on the border of Canada. You'll see that there. Otherwise, Class Golf is essentially really low and it's outside or below Class Echo airspace. So we know that at certain altitudes, Class Echo starts at 1200 feet AGL, unless otherwise depicted. Sometimes it'll start at 700 feet AGL. That is your magenta shaded line. The inside of the line is where you have the shaded, or rather the airspace. So you'll typically see these around airports, which coincides with the approaches that'll be going into that airport. And then you'll see that airport break down to the surface area as well, which will be a dashed magenta line. So that's Echo, but anything below that is going to be Golf. And that's really important because Golf can give you lower weather minimums for getting into rural airports. And so it's not so much seeing where the airspace is, the Class Golf airspace, is seeing where everything else is not. So if you know that there's not something else there, like Echo at 1200 or to the surface, then you, or 700, 1200, 700, then to the surface, you know that it's Class Golf underneath that. So it's a little bit out in left field. It's kind of weird that these things are there, but not depicted, but Class Golf is something to look at. And not really, because it's kind of invisible. They don't even show it to you. Okay, this is a good question. The FAA is big on this loss of control thing right now, base to final turn, where people can typically get uncoordinated and there are a lot of accidents that happen in this area, or at least when it comes to loss of control, there are a particular amount of accidents on that base to final turn. So someone asks, as a student, how do you ensure no stall spin on base to final? So I always want to be careful with this conversation because I feel like the first thing people will jump to is airspeed, and airspeed is not the whole picture. We know that airspeed is just an indication of how well the wing can fly. So while we don't want to get too slow on that base to final stretch, you can actually theoretically fly that pretty slow as long as you know what angle of attack is and you're using that. Now, angle of attack isn't indicated in any way unless you have one of these new angle of attack indicators. But it's not so much a thing of airspeed, because what I mean by that is you can get into that base to final turn, and if you pull back enough and get into an increased load factor situation and get your critical angle of attack past where the wing will fly, then you can stall at even a high airspeed. Remember that the aircraft can stall at any airspeed. So pointing out airspeed is something we have to be really careful with. So if I'm just teaching a student about the very basics of how to remain safe in that base to final turn, we do have to look at that indication of airspeed. You know, in our airplane, we're going from typically 70 miles per hour down to 60 miles per hour or 65 miles per hour from that base to final area, depending on where you're at in the pattern and how tight you have it. But we need to worry about coordination there. We need to keep the airplane coordinated. We need to also make sure that if we overshoot the runway, this is one of the typical things that happens. You don't compensate for the wind, right? Say the runway is right here. You come past and you try to fight back for it, right? You might kick the rudder and get yourself uncoordinated, and then you start pulling back to get yourself back there. That's, I think, where people get into the most trouble. So if you come past that final, just keep flying it past and then come back and get back on track. That is what I want students to realize, that them continuing to pull and increase the load factor regardless of the speed is really what's going to cause the stall. So if you're going to come from that that base to final turn and you do want to pull, you also need to let the nose down and lose some altitude there if you're actually going to do that into a bank turn, okay? So keeping in mind that angle of attack at all times is super, super important. But I just wanted to word it that way rather than saying, oh, just check your airspeed and check your coordination, because I think the big factor here is that load factor that people forget about, and the fact that you can stall the airplane at any airspeed. And when you're uncoordinated and you really pull back quickly, say to get back on that final approach course and try to line up perfect, that's kind of the perfect scenario. So hope that made sense, but that's how I view it at least. Okay, good question. Slow flight, should we hear the stall horn or not? ACS says no, but shouldn't we be used to the controls at that AOA? So this is actually something that deserves a little bit of history. Now, the ACS is the Airman Certification Standards. It's something that has been rolled out over the last several years. And initially, when they rolled out the Airman Certification Standards, or the ACS, I'll refer to it as ACS now, for private pilot, they said that they did not want you to get to a full stall. They wanted you to hear the horn and then recover from the stall. The thoughts there were that it would not train your brain to hear the stall and ignore it and continue to pull back, but that you would hear the stall and recover from the stall. There's a lot of pushback from the instructor community on that we wanted to keep the stall in the ACS. There were some arguments between different people on what they thought, some professionals in the industry. And I think at the private pilot level, it is good to understand what a stall actually feels like. The reason is because when you have a stall horn and that's it, you're only hearing something. You're not seeing or feeling really anything else. Now, getting close to a stall, of course, you're going to feel some stuff. And you should really know when you're getting close to a stall, you're feeling the pressure pulling back, perhaps. You're hearing a slowdown of the airspeed, perhaps. And your angle of attack in relation to the horizon, in this case, might even be quite high. However, if you get to a full stall, you get a lot more cues. You get shudders, you get shakes, you get whistles, all sorts of different things that are happening to the plane that give you even a greater indication of how close you're getting to stall. And that, for me, is something I want students to at least know in the private pilot level. Sometimes DPEs or instructors will have you do it just to the stall horn. I teach my students to do it to the stall, so that they understand they need to simply release that pressure to recover from the stall. Because at the end of the day, this isn't about the fact that you as a pilot can get in a stall. We don't care if you can get in a stall. You shouldn't be getting in a stall anyway. We care that you can recover from one if you inadvertently get into one. So that's the whole premise of it. And I really, the pilot is what causes the stall. All you need to do pretty much any time is let go, theoretically. I mean, just letting go can sometimes be aggressive, but let go and the airplane will right itself, at least in the case of a lot of these training airplanes and the way that they're designed. So that's my thoughts on it. It really just depends on your instructor. They do give you the option now in the ACS. They did rewrite it to be that way. And I think that's the way to go. What's the best thing a student pilot can be doing in these uncertain times? So yes, uncertain times. We've got COVID-19, the coronavirus that is kind of wreaking havoc on the industry right now. People are stuck at home. That's why there are so many viewers here right now. I just think that we all need to keep our head in the game. This is going to end eventually, and we need to be ready for that time. And I find that right now is actually a really good time to prepare. So I'm big on getting things like ground school done before you actually start flight training. If you're already in flight training, say private instrument commercial, and you haven't finished your written test, it's a super good time. You're at home. You don't really have anything else to do. You're replacing a lot of the leisure time in a forced manner with something else. So you can go and you can binge Netflix, or you can go and binge ground school or something to help you out. So as a student pilot, you know, I would definitely just embrace the fact that this is a perfect opportunity to continue to study and work toward that goal at home and learn as much as you possibly can, so that when you do have the opportunity to get in an airplane again, you are way ahead of where you were, even though you may not have touched the controls of an aircraft in a while. But just realize that this will end. We will have an end in sight eventually. That's just the way it goes. And it looks like with this that we are trending that way. I know it looks really bad right now. It's going to get pretty bad over the next few weeks, actually, at least here in the U.S. There's still a lot of question marks, but we will make it through this, and aviation will be back. Everything will be back, and we'll just have to wait for that time, okay? Keep your head in the game. Keep working toward it, those things that can help you move forward. What is the difference between POH AFM and PIM? There's really not a huge difference in terms of the fact that it's required to be carried on the airplane. Now, over the years, some regulations have changed where initially the manufacturers could basically do their aircraft flying manual or whatever they called it. It is actually pretty random what they ended up calling it back in the day, to where now it's a standardized format that they have to do for new aircraft. So POH is kind of an older term. AFM is a newer term. So you just kind of have to sift through that. But that legal manual, whatever it is, does have to be on the airplane. It is a required document. The reason is say that you're out just, you know, gallivanting around and conditions are different than you thought, and you need to calculate your takeoff distance again. That's something that you want to do with the manual right there. So it is something that is required, but it's gone through this evolution of basically manufacturers being able to do what they want, to where now it's more regulated. In fact, you can see that same thing has happened with a lot of the equipment that is required on the airplane, and even the layout of the six pack as well. Okay. Before we didn't have a six pack. If you look at the old Bonanzas, the original 140s and 170s, Cessna 140s and 70s, they had a random layout of the instruments that looked aesthetically pretty nice, but they weren't practical for instrument flying. And so that was something that was standardized later. So it's just gone through this process. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's just something you need to be going through. Okay, this person asks, I'm working on my private and doing cross countries. Any suggestions on getting through diversions? They are kicking my butt. A couple tips here is when you are in a situation as a pilot and you get to the point where you decide you need to land the aircraft and stop the chain of events or whatever you see is unfolding in front of you, you're essentially saying, okay, this flight is over. I can't continue as planned. I need to make a diversion to a different airport. And I am going to make some decisions based on that. So does that airport have fuel? Does it have maintenance for the issue that you're having? Is that critical that it has fuel or maintenance? Do you need to get to the nearest airport under maybe more of an emergency situation? So there are some things you evaluate. I think one of the best tools these days is obviously ForeFlight. We have within our reach, we have nearest airports we can look at very quickly. We can see where those airport, what those airports have at a glance, and then we can literally go direct with that and navigate with the iPad if we had to, just in an emergency situation, kind of pushes all the other rules out the window. Now, if things are a little bit more relaxed, you just say, hey, there's weather up ahead at my destination. I just checked the weather and I can't land there because it's IFR and I'm a VFR only pilot, for example. Then you're in less of a rush. You know, you can work through the problem of, can I return to where I was? How much fuel in time do I have on board? Do I land somewhere up ahead, refuel, and then go home? So really, it's actually a holistic approach of what you do. But don't be so rushed to just dive in and like figure it out instantly. That's called impulsivity. You don't have to figure it out instantly. Think through the pros and cons of different places to go. And think of it that way rather than just, you know, going nearest and direct enter and you're on your way. You know, think through it a little bit more than that. Now, there are some other great tools with ForeFlight. For example, you can use two fingers and press it on the map. And it actually has a ruler and it tells you in time and gallons and direction and a bunch of other information in that ruler from where you are to an airport. And actually, you could even just look at the map on the map view and measure the different options that you have and see what's going to work best. Get an idea about a heading you can head toward right away. You can know how much fuel it's going to take to get there, how much time it's going to take to get there. Those are all modern tools that are just really helpful to know exactly where to go right away. And if you ever do have other issues, of course, there's always the thought of expanding the team. Remember that you can ask for help from air traffic control. You can ask for help from flight service if you need to and get more information by getting information from other people. So kind of a holistic approach there, but don't overthink it too much. Or maybe the message is give yourself time to actually think about it rather than just diving right in, because you don't have to make a decision instantly. You just have to make a safe decision based on what is safest for your flight. So I hope that makes sense. So this is an interesting way to ask this question. What are all the regs you have to know by to be a CFI, just by number? And I can tell you right now that CFIs don't know everything, okay? We're not encyclopedias, but there's obviously a set of regulations that we need to know. And then for me as a CFI, and most people as a CFI, we need to know where to find them is the most important thing. So one tool I use is I use an app for my regulations where I can go and search if I am questioning something that has come up, and then I can go and look at the language specifically. Because what I find is that people that want to just go and memorize numbers and memorize regulations, things start to get mixed over time and they start to get things confused. That ends up costing people money on check rides or delaying some sort of training because the CFI was not regularly referring to those regulations. So, for example, one of the biggest things that comes up, one thing we talk about the most are the experience requirements for different licenses. And I refer those on a constant basis, even though I feel like I know them for the most part. I'm constantly looking at them to see the language, to prove what I'm actually saying is correct and show the student where to look. Having it in an app form like that is really helpful because you're not going to go anywhere without your phone. So again, if you're out in the wild, you're out on the roads being our runway roads, you're out there flying somewhere, you can reference those regulations right in the right on your phone rather than memorizing everything. So again, a CFI doesn't know everything. They simply know where to look in a lot of cases. Something students unknowingly do and annoys CFIs. I try not to be annoyed by students because it is a pretty tricky process to learn. I think the things that are just common about students is A, they don't know how much work it takes to become a pilot. So especially a student pilot, someone that's always dreamed of becoming a pilot, someone that's just barely getting into it, they don't really understand how much work it actually takes. It takes a lot of work to do this, and they don't realize how much they have to grow as a person. So I think that's something that I'd like to see people understand more. I try to communicate that as much as I can through everything that I do. Of course, there's things in the airplane like correcting for wind correctly or right rudder usage. But that is typically a lack of knowledge on the other side of what the left turn tendencies are, when they're actually happening, and some exercises that were maybe left out on the part of me, the instructor, that could help that student. So I'm big on those things that are initially annoying or could be annoying later on. I'm big on those things being taught in the very beginning. Like the first 5 hours for me as an instructor student is typically all stick and rudder. I'm not even really that interested in communications at that point because this first 5 hours is so critical to them knowing how to fly the plane and will follow them throughout the rest of their career. So I'm really big on that in the very beginning, teaching them those left turning tendencies, teaching them where they're happening, teaching them, you know, overbank and adverse yaw and what the power does when we're pushing it in and out for that yaw as well. So those things I'm really big on in the first 5 hours. But again, going back to the very beginning, also knowing that it just takes a lot of work to become a pilot. This is a follow-up. I think this is the same person asking this question, but it is kind of building off of that previous question. What's the best way for students to remain proficient for a private pilot check ride after not flying because of the virus? So I think the biggest part, 80 to 90% of what you're going to be concerned about with the check ride is, again, knowledge sort of stuff. So people are usually more concerned about the oral portion of the check ride than they are the practical portion, the actual flying portion. I know that a lot of us think that because we can't fly in an airplane right now, then we're going to lose our skills. Some of that is true, but I can tell you that the skills come back a lot faster, maybe in a flight or two, than the knowledge that you would have lost if you don't stay on top of that. So again, keeping your head in the books, keep hammering on those things that are going to be in the check ride oral. I do have a course that I created for this. It's called Check Ride Ace. You can find it at checkrideace.com. Just think of acing your check ride, okay? So checkrideace.com. And I have a study guide for your oral that will, it's laid out basically in the order that you'll go through in your oral. And that'll help you keep your head in the game. Once you fill that out, it's kind of a fill in the blank. Then just keep going through it every several days to just keep churning through everything. And then once you hit that check ride, A, you're going to be ready for the oral, which is, for me at least, the scariest part. And then you'll be ready for the practical when all of this stuff clears up and you get to go up in an airplane again. That'll all take care of itself. But keeping your head in the game is just the biggest thing right now. Another friend of mine here, Dave, just says chair fly, which is another thing. I think you could make a good argument for chair flying, and you could also make an argument for using a simulator if you had one. But I think even without those, you could do really well by just keeping your head in the game with the knowledge component. But yeah, if you literally want to sit down in a chair at home and pretend you're going through the procedures of startup, taxi, takeoff, climb, cruise, descent, all those different checklist things, then that can be really helpful as well. From Griffin. So good evening, Griffin from NASA. What's really important to an FAA examiner during a private pilot check ride? So this oral portion that you're going to go through and the practical portion, the entire reason you're even doing a check ride is so that the government can ensure that you are going to be a safe citizen in the skies, okay? That you aren't going to do foolish things that could endanger the lives of the public. That is why the government is involved in this. So the DPE, their goal, the examiner, is to make sure that you are safe. They don't expect you to be perfect. They'll tell you in the very beginning, they don't expect you to be perfect. They try to put you at ease in the very beginning of the check ride, get to know you a little bit, make sure you know where the bathroom is, that you have water when you need it, all those things. And then the oral portion ends up being a conversation. A lot of people think it's an interrogation, that you're sitting down with this really smart pilot that's just going to grill you and all these different things. And that's really not true. Really, it should be a conversation kind of flowing and more scenario-based questions than, you know, tell me about this system or explain the square root of the flux capacitor. Like, they're not going to ask you stuff like that. They want to unfold it in the way that you're actually going to be flying. And usually that's done through scenario-based questioning, okay? That's how they've been trained. So they actually go through training themselves and do it that way as well, okay? Now, you don't have to be perfect. I think you asked another question about that. And they just expect you to know your stuff really well and be a safe pilot, fly safely. There's going to be stuff you don't do perfect, but as long as you're safe, you're fine. I'm not saying that you should come right in at the lowest common denominator. I think you should really prepare to be up there and be really ready for the check ride so that you're just on top of your game, because this is going to be some of the top proficiency you'll be at. And then over time from there, you'll probably degrade down until you get more training, and then you'll bump back up and slowly work your way down. That's typically how it works, okay? Is a flight simulator okay to use for IFR practice? Absolutely. In fact, it's one of the best uses of a flight simulator. You can buy flight controls for a flight simulator. You can even buy, I have a flight simulator right here. That's why I'm looking off screen. You can even buy like GPSs and controls and throttles and everything. You can get pretty crazy with it. But if you're just trying to keep your muscle memory of that scan and working through procedures, then it actually works pretty well. I really like X-Plane right now. It works really well right out of the box and connects natively with the iPad so that my ForeFlight will present itself just as if I'm in a real airplane. So that's also really helpful. And yeah, absolutely. Instrument flying on a flight simulator is such a huge way to not only keep fresh right now, but it's actually a great way to even train for your instrument training without some global pandemic, because you can do unlimited hours on your simulator and get really, really sharp and really understand what's going on before your check ride. Basically, the question is, are you basically allowed to fly still, even with COVID-19? In Belgium, all training flights are suspended. So there's not like a blanket suspension right now in the United States. There is this decree or rather, it's not even legal. It's not even legally binding, but the White House has said they want people to keep social distancing to slow the spread of the virus. And as far as I'm concerned, social distancing does not apply, or rather, you cannot achieve social distancing by being in an airplane with someone. So while it hasn't been legally banned, it's a smart thing to do right now to not do any flight training, to not fly with anyone else, unless it's the family that you're hunkered down with, or you're doing it solo. You know, I have all these thoughts of going up with friends right now or filming or doing different things. The only thing I know that I can do once I'm out of quarantine is fly solo. Okay. Even then, if anyone else is going to use the airplane, I'm going to disinfect it really well. I think we just have to be good citizens here. Okay. This sucks right now. We're not going to be able to fly for a while. It is what it is. Everyone needs to participate so we can just get over and done with this as soon as we possibly can. So, yeah. Regardless of what the law is, the common sense thing to do right now is to keep that social distance, and you can't do that in an airplane right now. Is air law the same in the US as it is in the UK for VFR pilot? Are there any key differences? I would say that it's drastically different. Here in the United States, you're very much allowed to do almost whatever you want in whatever airplane you want. I know that's a big statement, but I just know that in the UK, you have to file VFR flight plans. It's more of an IFR all the time environment. So here in the United States, flying is still very free, meaning you can go anywhere you want almost, and you can land anywhere you want almost. and not have landing fees and things like that. So yeah, it is actually drastically different. You might find some similarities with IFR and cloud clearances and things like that. But other than that, the law is very, very different. This is a good question. I think this one came from last night. After the current situation is over, do you think it's a good move to invest money in an aviation career? Look at what happens, fill things out. I have this faith that things will bounce back after we're done. Aviation isn't going anywhere. We have a lot left to do in aviation. We still need to connect the world. We still need to connect our nation, and we're shipping stuff more than ever around the world. So yeah, it's still a thing. It's still going to be a thing. There are going to be great opportunities. And so rather than waiting until this is over, now is the opportunity to get ahead. I think, at least in good altruistic ways and ways that are honest, now is a great time to get ahead. Find the positive in this current situation and find a way to get ahead right now. So for me, that means you're stuck at home. You can study. You can take this leap. You can start to study for a private pilot license, say, starting there. That's just a small investment to sign up for an online ground school. I have one of them that I do at angleofattack.com. Small investment, see if it works for you. Use this time towards something valuable. And then when you're done, keep taking the steps. Or when this is done, keep taking the steps. I just think that that in whatever ways we can, we should take advantage of this time right now and not just sit around and kind of wait for it to be over. Just my soapbox for a couple seconds. How can I alleviate the cost of flight training? First off, you could buy your own airplane. You could join a flying club. Those are very affordable ways to fly. You can pick between different flight schools, make sure you do some shopping, and that can always work. So, you know, same old tips there. Can you explain the difference in answering a question on the oral exam at the private pilot level versus answering a question on the commercial level? And there's not really a difference. Like, the check ride is a lot the same. You have a lot of the same questions, actually a lot of the same things you're being tested on in commercial versus private. But I think the big thing with commercial that people seem to forget, because it's nowhere in the name, and it's really, it might be in the ACS a couple of times, but it's just not talked about enough, is professionalism. I think that as a commercial pilot, you are committing yourself to a new level of professionalism. That means you need to know everything better. You need to know how you can move about more efficiently through the airspace. You need to be able to communicate better. You need to fly the airplane better. Everything needs to be better and more professional. We don't hear that enough when it comes to private versus commercial, but it really is the step up. When you do commercial, you need to commit yourself to professionalism and just go in there and hit it out of the park. Typically at this point, you would have been through two check rides already. And so you should have a little bit of confidence that you can fly the plane and just go do it and act like a professional. It's time. It's time to step up. It's time to get up to that next level. So that's kind of my soapbox. If you could fly in a different decade, what decade would you choose? Ooh, I think two different decades. Like, I think the 1920s would have been really interesting to fly in because everything was so new and they were breaking new records all the time and really exploring the limits of airplanes. That's when, you know, the transatlantic flight was done by Charles Lindbergh. I also think the 1940s would have been a very interesting time to fly in World War II. But knowing the mortality rate of pilots in World War II is pretty shocking, and I'm really not sure I'd want to be in an airplane during that time. Just those airplanes are still some of the best airplanes ever built, some of the most technologically advanced in comparison to the time ever built. And I just think what that generation did was absolutely amazing. So yeah, those are kind of the two that stand out. I think both would be very interesting. I just think it's cool. Especially the 1920s, thinking of a time where everything is unexplored. People have never seen what you're seeing from the air, and that's a common thing. Is it true that there is a shortage of flight instructors? Yes and no. I don't really know what is going on right now, because with the airline industry essentially stopping, and the progression of pilots to the airline industry essentially stopping, I think things are going to be pretty slow for a while. So we're kind of stuck there for now. Now, when there was the pilot shortage, if it still exists, is yet to be seen. But when there was the pilot shortage, it was the airlines were sucking up all the pilots and they were taking instructors too. So yes, instructors were very hard to come by, or at least experienced instructors or whatever. Like, instructors were moving toward the airlines very quickly as of 3 or 4 weeks ago. That's not the case anymore. It's changing a lot, even in the last several weeks. Best way to start studying for the CFI. I think CFI, I talk about this quite a bit. I think this question comes up every time I do one of these Ask the CFI live question and answer sessions, is the CFI check ride or preparing for the CFI. And I think the best way to prepare for it is to do the practical application of what you're actually doing. You know, as private pilots, we go out and we fly, and it's pretty much that simple. We go out and we do radio communications. We learn how to fly the airplane. We do our cross countries, because that's what you do as a private pilot. What are you doing as an instructor? You're not flying really anymore. The other person's going to be flying. You are teaching now, coaching, mentoring, whatever you want to call it. And to practice for the check ride, to prepare for the check ride, to even study, the best way to do that is to do practical, real-world applications of that. So the best way, I think, is to get lined up with some students. They could already be pilots if you want some guinea pigs, or you could go to your local flight school, offer your services for free. Essentially say, hey, I'll sit here and I'll teach ground to your students under your watchful eye. A lot of flight schools are amenable to that, especially the smaller flight schools, to just help. That's one of the best ways to learn. And then if you can link up with some of your pilot friends and do some mock training in an actual airplane, that will help too. Because you are teaching now. You're not proving you need to fly. You are showing that you know how to teach. And if you're not a natural teacher, and even if you are, you're going to have to apply that to an airplane now. But actually coming up with the scenarios and those situations where you can get the practical experience doing it is super helpful. This is a good question. This is kind of building off of our previous CFI question. So after completing your commercial, what is left to get your CFI, and how many hours do you expect? Really, it all depends on you. And I think, again, it goes back to your own preparation. A lot of how to prepare for the check ride is going to be what you do in person with people. So that time sitting down with someone at a desk at your local flight school, where you're under the watchful eye of another instructor, is free for you, right? It's just your time you're giving. It's not like you're getting in an airplane. Actual time in the airplane is pretty minimal. You do have to do a spin endorsement for your CFI. I suggest, you know, doing that wherever. Someone that's comfortable with it, someone that knows what they're doing. Even an aerobatic school might be a good place to do that. So spin training, you need to do your FOI, Fundamentals of Instruction. You need to do your FIA, your Flight Instructor Airplane, 2 written tests. And then you do your check ride. So 2 written tests, spin endorsement, and then your check ride. Other than that, there isn't any hour requirement at all. Like, you're just literally preparing to the point of proficiency that you think you're ready, basically. And then you can go for the check ride. So fairly simple and straightforward. Again, don't cut corners, try to practice teach. That's the best way to do it. Even if you're just doing that with your kids. And I think that'll work out. Good to see you, Dave. Hope you're doing well. What are your favorite aviation related books? One book I really like, I always come back to, in fact, it sits on my nightstand as like a permanent fixture there, is Stick and Rudder. I tend to take it on vacations with me as well, even if I don't end up reading it because we're too busy with family. But I take Stick and Rudder, the book, with me everywhere. Fantastic book. Really love that one. I think a book that sound, it's kind of funny to even bring it up, but a lot of people don't realize it's really important, is the pilot, or rather, why can't I think of this? The PHAC. It's the PHAC, but I can't think of the acronym. Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge. I thought it started with pilot. Anyway, Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge is literally like the free FAA textbook, but you can order it in paper form. And especially as a CFI, I have that with me all the time. It's back here on my shelf. If I have to deep dive into a subject with a student, we need to look at something, we can often crack that open. But it's just something that's great to have there for reference for like the rest of your flying career. And I really suggest that everyone has one of those as well. I read a great one recently, actually, called A Higher Call. And it was about a World War II Luftwaffe pilot. And Ace actually ended up being an ace, and a B-17. It's kind of this famous situation where this B-17 was crippled, and this Luftwaffe pilot came up on it and had pity on them and escorted them out of Germany. But this is the backstory of that. It's like the whole history, the life of the German pilot especially, and the life of the B-17 pilot and crew as well. One of the best books I've ever read. Just so amazing. Has lots of, they intertwine the aviation knowledge just so well, where it's entertaining and you still learn something, but then the history component, the personal component to it, the political component, everything is just really, really good. What kind of content do you recommend for instrument knowledge and practical test preparation? Obviously, you need to go through ground school. I find that a lot of people, when they get to the instrument level, they're already trying to take shortcuts and do like one of these accelerated programs where you rote memorize all the information for instrument. I don't believe in that. I think instrument, if nowhere else, instrument is the place to do ground school. So you've really, really, really got to do that. And then, you know, just preparing for your check ride is, I have check ride ace. You know, I don't want to keep like pushing that. That's not why I do these sessions, but you know, organizing your check ride and studying for your check ride is really important too. Okay, this is a good question. Is there any bad habits to avoid when practicing IFR in a simulator? Anyway. Yes. So here's the big thing with a simulator. Because it could be on the same computer that you play Call of Duty or Battlefield or Minecraft, if you're older and still in the Minecraft, anyway. You guys shouldn't be in the Minecraft by now if you're looking to get a pilot license. But if you are, anyway, it's on the same computer. It could be on the same computer. People tend to treat a simulator like a game. My biggest advice to avoid bad habits is to treat this as if it is a real airplane. Do everything the exact real way that you would do in a real airplane. You don't want to build hazardous attitudes or habits on a simulator that you would take into a real airplane, okay? So that's just my biggest advice. Other than that, practice your heart away. But if you're going to come down on an instrument approach and you reach your minimums and you don't see the runway or the landing environment or whatever you're looking for, then go around. Like, do your missed approach. Do what you're supposed to do in the real world in the simulator. That's what it's there for. So just treat it as real as you possibly can, and you should be good to go. Top three tips for mountain flying. I haven't thought of this at all. Know where the wind is at all times and how it's going to be crossing over the mountains, the valleys, wherever you're at, the leeward side and the windward side. So if you have say a valley here, right? And the wind is blowing this way, this is going to be the windward side, and this is going to be the leeward side. The wind is going to spill over this side, go down, and theoretically come back up. Performance is great here because you can climb, right? But if you're messing around right here, then you could get caught in a downdraft. Thinking that way, water flowing through a stream, over rocks, over boulders, that's tip number one. Tip number two, look for an out as much as you possibly can, an egress route where you can get out. A lot of the times they want you to cross ridges at a 45 degree angle, so that turn back in case you need it is a lot shorter. So that's one reason they do the turn back. That's kind of tip number two. Tip number three is, I think a good one here would be density altitude. So just realize that if you are in a higher environment like that, your airplane isn't going to perform as well. I'm here at sea level and we have mountains that jut up to 6,000 to 11,000 feet, essentially out of the ocean. And so flying around mountains, we're actually in some pretty good cool air a lot of the times. But if you're flying the Rocky Mountains, it's a hot summer day. You're taking off at 6,000 to 8,000 feet MSL at the airport. You're going to be at a very high density altitude. So density altitude, you got to be super careful with there as well. Okay. Lots of other rules. I mean, I've flown around mountains a whole lot, but I think those are the big ones. Visualizing what you're seeing, having a plan to egress out, and then watching your density altitude. Those are just three that I'll kind of pull up right away. I'm a high schooler looking to become a pilot. How should I juggle flying and school? It's a tough one. I did a podcast a while ago, several months ago, to go and look at. It's a podcast specifically for teenagers and how to become a pilot. Gives you advice specifically for you at that level, at that time in your life, that I think could be super helpful for you. So go and look at that. It's largely about living a different life than most of your teenager friends and applying some of your leisure time toward flying if you possibly can. So go listen to that. Very, very helpful. I think that'll help you a lot. Is learning starting training in glass cockpits a good idea, or should there be gauges as well? It all depends on your instructor. Earlier on in this episode, I talked about stick and rudder flying. I'm big on stick and rudder flying. You can do stick and rudder flying even in something with G1000 or glass cockpit or whatever. It all depends on your instructor and how they teach it. So you can cover up those screens. You still have a wing that flies. You still have an engine. You still have a propeller. Everything's the same except for those avionics. So I really, really encourage you to learn those stick and rudder skills early, because otherwise, you know how it is. We're all really glued to our screens. If you have those screens in your face in the very beginning, you're going to have a tendency to look at them and all the cool little symbols on there and try to understand and fly that way almost by instruments in the very beginning. But you should have your eyes outside a lot, and that's hard when you have those big, nice screens right there. So have an instructor that will teach you how to do it that way, okay? Getting into the stick and rudder flying, even flying something with a glass cockpit. I'm doing your IFR ground school and got to shoot some approaches for the first time today. Just want to say it was awesome and thank you. Very, very cool, man. There's nothing like shooting approaches. It's like the pinnacle of aviation learning. So the premise of this question is going to get cut off for you guys. When becoming a CFI, how much of a challenge is it to teach a student to fly the airplane, communicate with ATC in those tough situations, and basically do everything at once? You know, it's a building block approach. And so you basically just add one thing at a time until your student is ready. I teach the stick and rudder skills super early. Then I add the communications. Then obviously we're working on landings kind of the whole time. Then there'll be more of a focus on landings. So it's a process. But it can't all happen at once. If you try to unload it on them all at once, then they get overwhelmed and then they're not learning anything. You got to get them to the point where they're almost overwhelmed. That's a really good point of learning. And then you make sure that they aren't going beyond that, because once they do, they can't really learn well anymore. But challenging them and bringing them to that point, whatever level that is for them, is super essential. Can't find the right place to put my feet on the rudders, especially for short field. So the danger or the problem with having your feet on the pedals during a short field, you want to obviously stop quite quickly, because that's the whole idea, right? You're going to come down, you're going to land fairly quickly, but you don't want your toes to be on the brakes when you touch down. That can make you nose over. If you have a tailwheel aircraft, that can be particularly bad. Then you're over on your nose. I typically keep my feet down, and then I just move them up when I'm ready to use the brakes. That second or so there, 2 seconds, whatever you want to call it, it's not a big deal. So just keep them normal on the rudders and then move them up when you're ready to brake and then apply your braking. So that's my advice. Otherwise, your feet get a little weird and then you can't quite control the rudder when you're flaring and touching down in that nice little sweet spot you're trying to find, and it gets too messy. So give yourself permission to go from your normal stance on your rudder or your pedals to moving those feet up to be able to use the brakes. Okay. Thank you everyone for joining on this episode of Ask the CFI. I hope you got something out of this. Please subscribe to our channel and turn on notifications. Also, join the conversation. If you liked a question or want to improve on a question or add more to the conversation, jump in those comments and participate. I'm always monitoring them. And if you want to get this in podcast format, say that you are commuting or something, you can find that anywhere, iTunes, Spotify, etc. Also, go to angleofattack.com if you need any official training for ground school, check ride preparation with Check Ride Ace. And we even do flight training here in Alaska, which not a lot of people get to do because not everyone's coming to Alaska. But if you do find yourself in the area, then perhaps we can fly together for real. So hope you're well, especially during this time, and you're finding ways to make positive strides in your flight training. And if at any time you need help, you need to bounce something off of me, you can do so through Instagram direct messages is the best way to do that right now. And I answer back. So anyway, good luck. Talk soon. And until next time, throttle on.